afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is the fourth in a series of five lectures devoted to 20th century masters of American painting. Today's lecture will investigate the works of Willem de Kooning, who, along with Jackson Pollock, discussed in last week's talk, and Robert Motherwell, to be examined in the next lecture, helped to create in New York City during the late 1940s a highly original and powerful artistic style called abstract expressionism, a style which was to have worldwide ramifications. These men, through their contact with the major European developments such as Cubism and Surrealism, not only joined American painting to the European mainstream, but determine and will determine the course of painting for many years to come. Although abstract expressionism was never a specific school nor a predetermined movement, the name, as some of you may remember who were here in the last lecture, was applied by several critics in the late 40s to the works of Pollock, de Kooning, Motherwell, and others, because these critics found in those paintings certain aspects in common, aspects which had never been found in painting before. That is, these paintings were both abstract and expressionist at the same time. Now, if we look at the paintings on the screen, both of them by Willem de Kooning, the one on your left from the period in which he made his major breakthrough, that is from 1947, and which earned him the name of abstract expressionism, and the period from 1958, you might see exactly how these terms came to be applied. You will notice that in both paintings, you cannot find any recognizable figure or object, no table, nor chair. At the same time, if you compare it to another painting in which no recognizable objects or figures can be found, both being abstract or non-objective, you will notice a major difference. The one on the right by Mondrian, done 20 years earlier, is primarily intended to balance the forms, the reds and the blues against the white. There is no interest in the manipulation of paint or in expressing just what paint can do. Whereas in the de Kooning, like the Pollock, there is interest in paint, in expressing through this paint, through the restless lines, the struggle of the painter himself. And I'd like to read you a quote that was written in the late 40s by a critic called Harold Rosenberg. And he said, quote, "At a certain moment, the canvas began to appear to one American painter after another as an arena in which to act. Rather than as a space in which to reproduce, redesign, analyze, or express an object, actual or imagined, what was to go on the canvas was not a picture, but an event." And by that, he means the event of the creation of the painting. And he added, "The act painting is of the same metaphysical substance as the artist's existence. The new painting has broken down every distinction between art and life." And though this painting by de Kooning seems on one hand very radical, it actually stems from a reaction that began at the end of the 19th century. A reaction that was against the idea of naturalism, that a painting must reproduce the external reality. And this reaction can be said to have begun with the painters of Gauguin, painting on your left, and Van Gogh. Gauguin, who dared to use a non-naturalistic color here in this painting, titled Vision After the Sermon, Jacob Struggling with the Angel, he dared to use in this painting red for the ground instead of green, because he wanted to stress the idea that this was a painting of a vision, not of a naturalistic or material event. And Van Gogh, also, painting on the right, tried to use color in a non-naturalistic way for expressive reasons. Thus, he put green tints in the skin and made the skin also unnaturally white, contrasting the greenish tone and the white, to suggest the pallor of a diseased man. This painting was done 6 months before he committed suicide, But Van Gogh also added something else to this idea of non-naturalistic color for expressive purpose. He added the idea of using paint and using the brush stroke in a communicative way, or you might say an emotive way. Notice how thickly he applies the paint. Notice how you can see the brush stroke itself, very agitated. All this, again, to emphasize the idea of the torments that he was going through. And this is something that is picked up by the abstract expressionists and by de Kooning over 60 years later. This use of distorted color continued in Germany. This is a Nolde done in 1914 and carried on where Van Gogh and Gauguin left off. Here, color is even used less naturalistically, and the forms now are begun to be flattened. Here, using the yellow faces, the sinister looks to express the idea of extortionists. This use of expressive color and flattening of figures was carried on further by Kandinsky in Germany. This painting was also done around 1914. And here, he even hides the figures. There are some figures here, at the bottom, and over here in the waves. He hides figures and wants to use primarily these colors and these forms for the purpose of conveying the idea of chaos that he felt was in the world at that time. And he said he wanted to do away with figures even flattened out like this so that people would not get involved in the narrative, but they would get involved in the whole idea of what he was trying to express. And he tried to do this just through the paint and through the colors. Now, while the expressionists were destroying the idea of naturalistic color in space, destroying it for expressive reasons, the Cubists in France, and this is a Picasso done in 1909, were also trying to attack something else. They were attacking the very notion of a painting. They were trying to establish the fact that a painting was, first of all, a two-dimensional object, a flat canvas on which painting was applied. And they were attacking a tradition that went from the Renaissance. This is a Renaissance painting, Raphael, done in 1504, which saw a painting as an illusion of the infinite space of external reality. And to show this infinite space, that a painting could be a mirror of this external reality, they used the laws of perspective, in which the people in the foreground would be larger, the ones in the background, of course, smaller, according to the diminishing laws. And thus, they could convey this great spatial recession. Picasso tried to attack these very ideas, and to emphasize that a painting was, first of all, a flat canvas, he joined the figure and the background by making a small pattern of brush strokes across the whole canvas. At the same time, in destroying this illusion of infinite space by the laws of perspective, he wanted to show that a painter does, after all, concern himself with space, even if he is not concerned with three-dimensional illusionistic space, as this Renaissance space could be called. So Picasso drew shadows here, put black here to make this area recede, and put white here, which would come forward, again to show that he too can create illusion of space on the canvas at the same time that he is showing you, by using this similar pattern and brushwork across the whole canvas, that this is something, first of all, flat and two-dimensional. Also, Picasso struggled to work out a new vocabulary of forms in addition to a new ideas about painting in space. And in this painting, done about 5 years later, in 1914, called Harlequin, he has reduced all forms to simple geometric shapes, rectangles, diamonds, squares. And he has then used these forms to create the image of the Harlequin. Note the diamonds of the Harlequin's costume and how they've been formed into the total pattern. Here, space now is created by overlapping flat planes. This plane, blue, placed in front of this plane, to create an illusion of space, though very shallow. This vocabulary of using geometric forms was to dominate painting all over the world for the next 20, perhaps 30 years. Here is a painting by Leger, also French, done in the 30s, in which you see this Cubist vocabulary of translating forms into geometric shapes, now become used for its own sake. Here there is just an interest in the balance of one form against the other, in arranging these in a perfect symmetrical order, as you saw earlier with the Mondrian. This had an effect even on a painter like Kandinsky, who we saw earlier in 1913, was trying to work out somewhat of this abstract expressionist ideas, but he only worked in that style for, say, 2 or 3 years, because then he became influenced by Cubism, and the majority of his paintings till the end of his life were in this style, much more interested, again, in these pure geometric shapes. Now, while Cubism was attacking the idea of the illusion of three-dimensional space as represented on the canvas, another movement, the Surrealists, were also attacking the idea of the conscious as an illusion, attacking the idea that the conscious force was the dominating motive in mankind. Influenced by Freud, they tried to stress the importance of the unconscious as the determining factors in mankind's development. And thus, in their paintings, you find this reflected both thematically and stylistically. Note in this painting by Picasso, which can be seen at the Museum of Modern Art, that's done in the early 30s, he uses this idea of the double image, the conscious image and the unconscious image here. The forms, you will notice, stem directly from Cubism, the flat geometric shapes in a very shallow space. But the forms are mostly geometric in the background. Working with the figure, he invents a somewhat new vocabulary. If you remember the Harlequin, the entire human figure of the Harlequin was decomposed into those geometric long rectangles. Whereas here, he's begun to use more organic biomorphic shapes, curves. These biomorphic shapes are then picked up by other surrealists and exploited as being more in keeping with the ideas of the unconscious. And here on the right is a painting by Miró, another surrealist done in the 30s, in which he uses these biomorphic shapes. This painting is called Two Personages. And here you might see the man with the whiskers. You can pick the whiskers out here, the long nose, the eyes right there, and the long sort of oval biomorphic body. And the female here. Again, certainly not based exactly on human forms, but these round shapes are certainly more humanistic than are the geometric ones. This idea of biomorphic forms in a loose floating atmosphere was also carried out in America by an Armenian painter named Gorky. And Gorky, as we shall see, was to have a profound influence on the career of our painter de Kooning. Again, these biomorphic shapes stemming from the idea of surrealism and capturing the feeling of the unconscious. But also in trying to emphasize these ideas of the unconscious and its importance, the surrealists were determined to find even a more emotive and exploratory style. Going from the biomorphic forms, they also started to work with the ideas of chance and automatism. In this drawing by a surrealist called Masson, you will notice there's a small dark circle here. And Masson started with the idea of a doodle. He thought, if the unconscious is the most important thing, I will try to get at my unconscious. And thus, he put his pencil on the paper here and closed his eyes and began to draw like that. And when he saw what emerged, he then began to work with this, and he added some lines down here. And the whole thing, which emerged, he called Flight of the Birds, because this is what it reminded him of. This whole idea of using doodles, of dropping paper, as was done by Schwitters, on the canvas, and then pasting it where the paper fell, this whole idea of exploiting the unconscious is really the surrealist contribution. And as we shall see, this is greatly picked up by the painters living in New York. Now, de Kooning was actually born in Holland in 1904. and he left school at the age of 12 to become an apprentice to a commercial painter. He also studied at night at an art school, and there, of course, he came into contact with the dominant ideas of the day, the geometric abstraction of Mondrian and Leger and the late Cubists. This is very important because he always would say that he was reacting against these geometric abstractionists. He considered them too lifeless, too uninterested in expression, too static. So when he came to this country in 1926, there's very little known about the type of works he did then. We know he drifted from various jobs. In the 30s, he met up with Gorky, whose painting you saw earlier, the Surrealist. His first paintings thuz, and this is the de Kooning on the left, show the influence of the Surrealist style. We see on the right a Miro, and I think it can be clear how this organic sort of human shape head and a neck comes out of this Miro Surrealist atmosphere. Here this is a Miro titled Nude, again this organic shape. However, de Kooning was also looking at the Cubists, and he adds to this Surrealism flat organic shapes. Some idea of a shallow space. Here he puts a pink plane, again to show this is a slight recession here. Another painting by de Kooning, done in 1939, this one on the left, again shows how hard he looked at the Miro type of Surrealism. Again, these same organic shapes, flat, moving across the canvas, with de Kooning looking again still at Cubism, with adding some geometric shapes, not being able to leave it yet. At the same time that he was working in this Surrealist abstract style, de Kooning in 1939 was doing some portraits. Here's a painting of a man done in a somewhat naturalistic style. He was soon to abandon this in favor, this is the de Kooning on the left, in favor of the Picasso, again, type of Surrealism. Again, the shallow space, the flat forms. But here, de Kooning adding something different, having the paint much looser and freer than Picasso. And this was something that Gorky, the slide is on the right, that Gorky was adding to de Kooning's vocabulary. For Gorky was beginning to use paint much more freely and much more loosely, again in almost the German expressionist sort of quality, in contrast to the flat, tight Cubist painting. We begin to see this in the de Kooning painting titled The Wave, and this was done in the mid-40s. Here de Kooning is beginning to loosen his forms, make them much more flexible. The outline is not very tight. And the paint, again, you can see the stroke of the brush here and here. And perhaps this does come from Gorky's influence, with whom he shared a studio at that time in New York. Now, many of these, because of the war, many of the Europeans, such as Masson, whose painting you see on the screen on the right, had come to New York and were living in a small colony of Frenchmen. Many of the Cubists also had come to New York, such as Leger and Mondrian. And all this added a very bubbling atmosphere to what was going on. It was very unusual for Americans to have so many foreigners living in this country at that time. And up until that time, there had been great bitterness among the Americans, and de Kooning can be considered American since he started painting in this country, rather really than Holland. Because there was bitterness at this time because most of the paintings bought were those that were French. An American painting was considered practically worthless. It was considered imitative. And so, at the one hand, when these foreigners came to this country, there was, on one hand, a rejection of them, and yet a great curiosity about them. Also, at the end of the 30s, in New York, there had been the founding of the Museum of Modern Art and the founding also of this museum, where a great many modern paintings could be seen finally and not in reproductions. And this, of course, had a very important effect on the developments in the 40s. Now, Masson certainly can be said to be responsible, partially responsible for the change in de Kooning's style, this change from the early Miró-like surrealism with the flat forms. Here already you see the Masson's slightly more organic forms. Again, he started from this idea of a doodle on the canvas, these black shapes doing one after the another. And then the idea occurred to him that these could be called a cockfight. This is what these black shapes suggested. Perhaps also this can be related to the forms used here, these black forms used by de Kooning. And also he started from this doodle, and it suggested to him the idea of a wave. These loose biomorphic forms were expanded by de Kooning, and this is a painting from 3 years later. This was done in 1945. And if you look closely, you might see this human image, quite distorted, bent and curved, very loosely painted, the outline of the body merging with the background, and again, repeating the color from this biomorphic human form here in the background. This is part of the landscape, trying to merge image and landscape into one. Again, this is something that one could say was suggested first by the surrealists. Now we come to 1948. This is a painting called Just Painting, and it's in the Museum of Modern Art. And de Kooning begins to break through from this influence of surrealism and to really begin to expand into something called an abstract expressionist. One must remember that all the paintings of Masson, the cockfight, or the flight of the birds, were very few. And though he tenuously worked with these ideas of doodles and trying to paint what might come from them, what might come from the unconscious, he produced very few works. Most of them were primarily experiments. And it was people like de Kooning and Pollock who picked up from these experiments and truly exploited them. At the same time that de Kooning was doing the painting on the right, we find a painting very similar in nature by Gorky. Gorky, he no longer shared the studio with Gorky, but they were in communication all the time. And de Kooning always acknowledges his debt to Gorky. You'll notice both of them using these loose biomorphic forms, but spreading them all over the canvas, no longer separating image from landscape, but trying to blend them into one uniform design. You'll notice that both of them begin to use the idea of drips. And if you look here at the right, you will notice in the de Kooning how he has actually let black just run down on the canvas and see what has evolved. He's also used drips really throughout the whole painting. This is black again on white. Here, Gorky has done this with color. He's used gray and poured actually the gray on the canvas and see what forms evolve from this. This has allowed a much freer, much more expressive vocabulary. And for the purpose of all of them to trying to express the struggle of creation. For de Kooning, he tries to express always an ambiguous form. And thus, these forms at one hand suggest dismembered human shapes, and at the other hand, they seem completely unintelligible. This Masson, this is another Masson. This is done in 1927. And it's just to remind you again that this was an experiment by Masson. He started the doodle here in the middle of the canvas and drew, and they suggested fishes. He also threw sand on the canvas and again worked with this and see what it suggested. But this was only experiments. It was de Kooning who would then work with the paint, throw paint on the canvas, and then see what it would suggest. As you remember, that it was Masson also who led Pollock to his development. Some of you who are here in the last lecture might remember this painting by Pollock in which he was working with the same ideas of Masson, starting here in the center, closing his eyes, then drawing quickly over the canvas and seeing what evolved. But you'll notice that this is still very tight and not very free. There's too much crosswork here. But it was this working with doodles, this automatic painting, which evolved into the great Pollock canvases of 47 and 48, which are of equal importance to the de Kooning ones of 47 and 48. Again, here, instead of working with drips and Pollock poured the paint from the bucket onto the canvas in one continuous interwoven swoop. If we compare the Pollock with the de Kooning, you'll see at one hand the similarity, at one hand the confused, chaotic shapes wiggling all over the canvas, the restless line. Again, the emphasis on the two-dimensional canvas coming from cubism, and at the same time trying to show you that, yes, this is a flat canvas, but space, illusionistic space, can be created. If you compare now a de Kooning with a Mondrian, the Mondrian that he was always trying to get away from because he said that those abstract paintings were too lifeless, too static, you will notice that this is a Mondrian called Broadway Boogie Woogie. He did this when he came to this country in 1941. He was moved by the motion in this country, by the lights on Broadway, and he wanted to capture this restlessness of New York on his canvas. And the only way he could see to do this was to break up his huge squares into small ones and intersperse the yellow with red, black, and gray, which sort of goes dot, 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 and move somewhat, but it's always very, very controlled. Certainly a painting like a de Kooning, though abstract also, is so much more free and much more expressive. This line, which appears tortured, is communicative always of the struggle he was going through at that time, communicative of his idea that painting was the most important act, the most universal act. Now, if you notice again how de Kooning uses this idea of tension to emphasize this struggle of a painter. And he draws upon the Cubist vocabulary of tying in foreground or object and background. Although the de Kooning at first glance seems like perhaps a decorative pattern running horizontally across the canvas, you will notice if you look closely shallow pockets of space, as you could notice in an early Picasso Cubist painting. De Kooning creates this because black will tend to come forward here and appear to be drawn over the white, and the white will tend to recede. And if one looks very closely, you will notice that the whole line of the canvas moves from this point diagonally up to that point. This creates somewhat of a tension because it is very ambiguous, because there is no perspective, no illusionistic, realistic space. You expect at one hand only to see flat forms, not tormenting you at all with one being there and then receding. De Kooning always works with this idea of a form at first coming forward and then going backward, always to suggest that clarity is not the important thing. Now, in 1951, de Kooning worked with an entirely new idea, and he produced his famous Woman series, which are equal in importance to those paintings of 47 and 48. In this painting, you notice, this is at the Museum of Modern Art, and you can see it. It's quite large. It's about 7 feet high, 6 feet across. You will notice he begins to use this line, this restless line that he used in the painting earlier, the Black Friday that you saw on the screen just previously. And he begins to use this line for another purpose, to begin working with the image. He said about this painting that this image of the woman came to haunt him. He could not get it out of his mind. He would paint a canvas and she would emerge. He would try to destroy it and she would come back. This went on over a period of years. This is another one called Woman 2, also in the Museum of Modern Art. And this is one from 1955, and another of the woman. Again, one notices this vigorous use of paint, the slashing brushstroke, the forms which are at once there and which recede with the background. And one might ask, where does such an image come from? Is there anything, again, in our tradition that these forms can be connected with? You might remember the earlier de Kooning portraits, where he looked at the Picassos and tortured form, Or you might go back to the German Expressionists. This is an older on the left, where paint, again, was used so unnaturalistically and expressively. And yet, nothing really can compare to this de Kooning form, which is on one hand monstrous, horrible, and people have said it suggests the fat woman in the circus or some of the ugly models you see on the billboards. And others have said it's a satire on Marilyn Monroe. But actually, one can go back to prehistory, to this figure, which is actually a religious idol, a fertility goddess, which was found in Austria. It's called the Venus of Willendorf, named mainly from the place from which it was found. And again, you see de Kooning trying for some broad humanistic interpretation, now going back to prehistory for his forms and trying to make some connection with this idea of this woman, at once horrible and yet, as you must know, worshipped by the tribes. Or one can go into Africa and look at their religious idols here, an ancestor god, and again see de Kooning looking at these primitive figures, these figures that had meaning to all the people in their tribes, and trying to learn something from them. Here, you might notice the teeth barred, how de Kooning actually works with this. You might see the teeth here, the hollow eyes, the enlarged breath. All this, these primitive forms de Kooning works with to try and make something monumental and permanent out of this image. But in working with this torturing image, the woman, de Kooning also involves something else, something which he could even get at more fully, this idea of the struggle of a painting and this whole problem of communicating to you, the spectator, the nature of the artist's creation. In the woman paintings, and as he said, he attacked always this woman that emerged in the paintings, slashed at her with his brush. He involved an even freer brushstroke, something that goes beyond what the surrealist did, goes beyond what he did even in 47 and 48. Here's one called Woman 5. This was done in 1955. You can pick out the woman mainly just because of the eyes here, and perhaps the yellow for the head and the pink flesh arms. But most of the woman blends with the background in these huge, broad areas of paint, flat strokes, slashing color. He begins to work with this and to blot the image out entirely. But it took 5 years for him to get to this point. And this is a painting called Composition, also done in 1955, in which he finally has blotted out this image of woman. You might see her, perhaps, if you look hard. People are always finding woman in de Kooning's paintings. You might see her here, the head here, and the long figure there. But what is important is that de Kooning was able to free himself mainly from the tyranny of the line that he had used earlier in the Black Friday and the black painting in the Museum of Modern Art, the line that he had used torturously to communicate his tension and his torture. Now he begins to use paint much more fully. He uses colors that are purposely jarring, this orange pitted against this shocking aqua. Again, playing on these things to jar you, the spectator, into his field, into his world. If we look at this detail of this composition, you'll see even clearly how de Kooning actually attacks the canvas. He uses a very large brush, raises his arm, and then strokes. He does not make a sketch. Most of the abstract expressionists work directly on the canvas, and this is something in contradiction to earlier painting. Even Picasso, even the other cubists, even many of the abstractionists, the geometric abstractionists, such as Mondrian or Leger, worked their paintings out in sketches before they dared to commit them to the canvas. But with de Kooning, with Pollock, working from the ideas of the surrealism, exploiting this idea of the unconscious, they attacked the canvas directly. And every evidence of de Kooning's decision, whether to put white here or red there, becomes evident in his canvas. And this is what is meant by the abstract expressionist, expressing through abstract means this whole problem of creativity. One will notice again this spatial problem, the problem of tension, that at one hand this seems perhaps just chaotic, no space at all, no depth at all. And yet if you look in the painting on the right, you will notice that there again tends to be a little path. You might start here, note that the red comes diagonally, leads you in beyond these black forms, which almost seem like a fence. You will move up there, and again notice how much deeper this seems, that this maroon, very dark, seems to recede even further. And if you look at this area now in the detail, you might see exactly how he does it, using the cubist overlapping planes, but also uneven edges and thick brush strokes. He does create this problem of illusion of paint on the canvas. If you compare it to an earlier de Kooning, the painting that we saw earlier, you will see just how much further he has evolved. Here in this painting, he's just begun to work with this idea of attacking the canvas directly with no sketch, exploiting the idea of drips here to see what expressive forms have evolved. But still, he's quite linear. Most of the forms are outlined. Whereas here, he no longer has to work with even that much of a reduction of outlines. He's able to work completely with this thick brush stroke. If we go into the canvases of even the more recent years, of 58, the one on the left called February and this one called Montauk Merritt Parkway, again, you can see just exactly how this canvas was painted. The blue first, then the yellow, then the red, the green slashed over that, and then finally the white strip thrust on the canvas. In February again, you see the use of the drips, the long brush strokes, the big strokes. And if one compares it with the Vermeer done in the middle of the 17th century, one might see that Vermeer was trying again to show the nature of the artist. Here is the artist painting a picture of a model, but actually being painted by Vermeer himself, trying to show you this problem again of art, imitation, reality, expression. But how does the Vermeer come anywhere near the de Kooning in communicating the torture, the tension, or the struggle of what a painter goes through? It is through these slashes, these jarring colors, the ambiguity of space, that the very problem, the nature of the artist is created. And if I may read you a quote from de Kooning, it might illustrate even further why he paints the way he does. He says he's always attacking the idea of painting as comfort, such a painting as Mondrian. He says, quote, "Their own sentiment of form was one of comfort, the beauty of comfort. The great curve of a bridge was beautiful because people could grow across the river in comfort. To compose with curves like that and angles and make works of art with them could only make people happy, they maintain, for the only association of these people was one of comfort. That millions of people have died in war since then because of that idea of comfort is something else." And thus de Kooning is saying, in our age, not only is this painting indicative of the painter's struggle and the very nature of painting, but it is indicative of the very times that we live in and the horrors that have been seen. Exactly what he will evolve in the future, it's very difficult for one to know. And here we see him working on a new woman series. These have just recently been exhibited, and working again new, even broader, freer paintings. Again, what will be produced in the future, time can only tell. Thank you.